Welcome to American Variety Radio. I'm your host, Court Lewis. You know, I had been hosting American Variety for a few years when one day it occurred to me that a pretty high percentage of my guests were people who pursued a difficult or unusual goal or dream, often against, you know, really tall odds and a lot of resistance and discouragement, but eventually they achieved it. And that wasn't a conscious, uplifting moral message on my part of, you know, something like, if at first you don't succeed, try again. It just happened that way. But maybe it reflects the fact that I admire people with gumption who pursue their dreams and their stories appeal to me. So over the years, I've had on many guests of that sort. Often they're artists and performers of various kinds, but also explorers and other adventurers, game-changing scientists, astronauts, and creative business people, and you know, just lots of people like that, a wide variety. Hey, what a coincidence, American variety of people. And so my guest today is one such person. He's a musician named Christian Tambor. And calling Christian a musician is a bit limiting. He is that for sure, specializing in jazz on the vibraphone and piano. But he's also a composer and arranger, a producer and a band leader who tours worldwide performing at major venues like the Lincoln Center, the Kennedy Center, and the Newport Jazz Festival, as well as being a musical director who puts on headline shows in places like Vegas. And he's also the CEO of a company that offers musically inspired presentations on leadership and training to corporate teams around the world. So in other words, he's a classic entrepreneur, but in a field where that's not too common, in other words, music. And when I ran across Christian and noticed that he's originally from Central Florida, where I'm from and where many of our listeners are located, that kind of clinched it for me. So welcome, Christian.
It's great to be here, Court. Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being on. That was a long introduction, but I'll bet I still left some things out. I hope what came across, though, is that you're an extremely busy guy. In fact, I think you just got back from California.
No, the jet lag is wearing off as we speak. I had my coffee. I'm ready to go.
Well, before we get into all the producing and business aspects of what you do, let's talk first about the core of it, which is your music. I mentioned that you play the vibraphone. For those of our listeners who don't know what that is, what is that?
I'm still trying to figure that out, Court. But I first started on the piano. And when I got into junior high school, I went to the band director and he said, well, the piano isn't a real instrument. You need to play a band instrument if you want to be a part of this game here. And so they were fresh out of clarinets and oboes. And so I decided to pick up percussion. And in the percussion family, we have the drums that most people are familiar with, the drum set or concert bass drum or snare drum, crash cymbals, timpani. And then there's the mallet instruments, the marimba, the xylophone, and the vibraphone. These instruments are just beautiful, and they have each kind of unique tones to themselves. But the vibraphone is relatively young in the family, being developed primarily as a sound effect instrument to be used on radio, which is a shame. I should have brought one out and had ready for this show. The NBC theme, bum, 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 that is the vibraphone. And this instrument was, again, used as a sound effect. And what started to happen was because it was made of metal bars and it had a sustain pedal, it played very much, very melodically and very lyrically, almost like a piano. You could hold notes out, unlike the marimba or the xylophone. And so this instrument became quite popular amongst the jazz musicians and ragtime marimba and xylophone players of the 20s and 30s. And the instrument kind of made its breakout into the world. And great players like Lionel Hampton, Milt Jackson, all, you know, that worked with Benny Goodman and all these great ensembles of the day, really brought this instrument to light. So it's very unique, hard to move around, but I love it.
Yeah, okay, so we're going to play a couple clips of your music a little later and people can hear for sure what that sounds like, but I think everybody's probably got a good idea. So you lead a group called, by some strange coincidence, the Christian Tambor Quintet.
Does your marketing genius.
Yeah, it was very, very, very original and creative of you, I had to say. But does your group do entirely jazz?
You know, that's where it all started. Nowadays, I try to live through this mantra of we just want to play great music. The influences are vast. In a nutshell, yes, we really revolve around the improvisational aspects of jazz. The ensemble is acoustic in nature, upright bass, grand piano, the vibes, drums. But, you know, really, at the end of the day, it seems like as we get further into the future, the labels that necessarily have to be placed upon what type of music do you play, I don't know, those box stores don't have those boxes anymore. So, yes, jazz is where it's kind of based out of, but we really do a lot of different styles of music.
Do you sometimes have horns, for example?
Yeah, so I love to collaborate with other artists. I love the tonality of the trumpet with the vibraphone. The two melodic instruments just meld so well together. I also work with some really wonderful vocalists. So the ensemble kind of ebbs and flows, depends on the budget.
Well, why don't we play a little sample of your music, as I warned the audience we would. So here's a thing called, and these are just clips, you know, out of longer tracks, and this one's called Double Check. I can see it showcases your vibraphone, so I think everybody has a better idea what that sounds like. How long have you had the group?
Boy, I guess my first, we're going to call it 2004, was essentially where I, you know, for the beginning part of my career, I was the special guest for a lot of other bands. And I enjoyed that because I got to mentor under some great band leaders, play with some great ensembles. But to essentially break out and lead my own ensemble, I was about 24 years old when I decided to take on that venture.
So, like, you must have had, in that long span of time, some pretty memorable concerts. What are, you know, maybe just mention a few of the ones that really stand out as being spectacular for you.
It's really hard to kind of narrow them down. Anytime I get to step on stage and make great music with great musicians is memorable. When I was very young, one of the first gigs I ever had was with a band leader out of the Central Florida area, a man by the name of Michael Andrew. And he had an ensemble called Swingerhead. And this was at the time of the kind of the swing fad that came back in the mid-90s. And I was still in high school. And we played places like Merv Griffin's Coconut Club and the Windows on the World on the 114th floor of the World Trade Centers.
Wow.
And so that was pretty surreal, being 17, 18 years old, you know, leaving school on a Thursday night, flying up to New York and playing, you know, these kind of amazing venues. And,
yeah.
So that was kind of how it all started. And now, you know, the venues that stick out to me in some of the performances are the first time I ever stepped on stage at the Kennedy Center was surreal. Walking into the House of Swing at Dizzy's Club in Lincoln Center. You know, these are iconic places that I remember when I was young going to and seeing some of my favorite mentors that I, you know, looked up to. And so, you know, you step on those stages and you you feel like you're joining a club, I guess. And so I've been to over 75 countries over the past couple of years. And again, so, you know, some of the memorable ones are the silly ones. You know, I spent a lot of time with Julio Iglesias and, you know, playing on the beach of a, you know, this romantic boutique villa off the coast of Marbella, Spain, you know, and the sun is setting and I don't speak a word of Spanish, but I think he's saying some beautiful stuff. So I've been very blessed to be able to experience some really wonderful performances over the past few years.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I mean, sometimes just the moment itself is magical and dreamlike almost.
Absolutely. It's why we do it.
You are listening to American Variety Radio. This is why we do it. I'm your host, Court Lewis. We're talking with musician Christian Tambor, and as we've been describing, he's kind of a multifaceted musician who gets involved in a lot of the business aspects of it himself and is very entrepreneurial and has kind of made his own road in music and has done it very successfully. I mentioned that you're a producer and an arranger, Christian. I know right now you're doing a live performance tour called Sounds for Sculpture, which sounds kind of unique. Why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. So I have collaborated over the past few years as a composer and arranger for a couple of different large producers out of New York, putting on shows either in New York on or off Broadway. And one of those producers was Cecilia Johnson. And Cecilia Johnson's husband is Seward Johnson. He is one of the most renowned bronze sculpture artists in the world. He comes from this Johnson & Johnson family. And when he was about 40 years old, I'd been, you know, doing the family business thing, and I don't think he liked it very much, and decided to pursue his passion for the arts. And he always wanted to be a sculptor, and he broke out and started doing his thing and has now become, you know, led quite an incredible career just doing that. And so I got to meet him, and it was interesting meeting him because it wasn't until I actually saw the work at his museum, which is just outside of Hamilton, New Jersey, called The Grounds for Sculpture, that I realized that I was familiar with Seward's work. I had seen it at Times Square. I had seen it at the Chicago Pier, at the National Harbor in D.C. I knew his pieces. And so I was like, oh my gosh, that's you? Yeah, I was blown away. And so it was kind of interesting because I got to know him before I even knew really who he was, if you know what I mean. And so our friendship was really quite pure, and enjoyed the fact that I got to kind of get to know him that way. And so by venturing out into this beautiful botanical gardens where they have all of his sculptures on display, I was really moved by the thematic impression or inspiration by viewing each piece, almost like a frozen scene in time from a theater piece. You know, these beautiful sculptures, and he's set in realism, so these characters are doing some sort of activity, and I could hear the music behind the scene. But that was frozen, if that makes sense. I'm always a good one for a solid pun, so I said, well, I'm at the grounds for sculpture. I said, what about sounds for sculpture? And I went to Seward and I said, I've got this crazy idea. I said, I want to write music inspired by your sculptures. And he said, yes. And so I selected 10 of his sculptures. And through the coordination and partnership with the Seward Johnson Atelier and the Grounds for Sculpture, created this brand new project, Sounds for Sculpture, The Awakening, which is actually a title piece of one of his beautiful sculptures. And now we premiered this at Lincoln Center in New York City in 2019. And we are now in the process of touring this kind of multi-dimensional, multi-sensory musical artistic piece where we have the music and the sculptures presented. It's really a beautiful experience for the audience. So it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, sometimes I have, over the years, had many artists of different kinds of genres on the show. And I'm always interested, you know, I'm kind of sort of a writing and also a science background. And so I'm always interested in things like the spark for creativity. And you mentioned that you saw the sculptures in that sculpture garden and that they kind of sparked a soundtrack in your mind. And was that literally like each one you would look at, you could hear a melodic line associated with it? I mean, how does that work in your brain?
Yes. So I've done a lot of work in, as I said, theater. I've worked for Cirque du Soleil. I've worked for large productions where I'm writing for a moment, right? So whether it's two characters in a scene or the setup for something that's to happen. So as I was walking through these, you know, and looking at these sculptures, I could hear the underscore. I could hear the underscore to that moment. And then so then I essentially took lots of pictures and brought them back to my house, sat them on top of my piano and started fiddling with it and really kind of evolved the melodic idea. But it was very easy to go from spot to spot. And this is over the course of 18 or 20 acres that they have these sculptures all over the property.
Wow.
That, you know, you would kind of venture into this new transformative environment. One would feel very romantic and kind of South American. And there's this girl and these animals kind of all, it's just like, you're like, oh my God, I'm in Brazil, you know? And then, you know, you would walk to another area and there would be what appears to be a man and a woman kind of having an argument as they sit on a park bench there. And I was like, well, I've been there, done that. I certainly know what that music sounds like. And so it really was, it kind of, they really told the story. And again, he has a great sense of humor. He has a great sense of capturing these, like the facial expressions. So it was very easy for me to just to pick my own imagination, you know, my own journey of what that story was. So it really kind of all kind of came relatively quickly.
So with all that variety and variability that you were just describing in the sculptures and in the kind of spontaneous, you know, expression they created in you, what's the music like in the show? Is it world music? Is it really eclectic and all over the place? Or what's it like?
I think the common thread through it is, of course, my artistic approach to composition. The core ensemble, which is based around my acoustic jazz group, you know, as I was writing the music, I definitely heard horn and I wanted to add trumpet. On specific pieces, I really heard lyrics. I really heard a story that needed to be told to kind of expand upon what the potential of that sculpture's story could be. So some lyrics were written, and so I have vocalist. I have one of my close friends that I actually went to junior high school and high school with in the Central Florida there, Michael Dobson, who was nominated a year and a half ago for a Tony Award, doing what's called Foley percussion for SpongeBob SquarePants. And he brought his Foley percussion, which is sound design percussion, which it's transformative. You know, you could, you know, they could be like a siren. It could be like chains wrestling across the grounds. It could be the rustling of leaves, really environmental sounds. And so he brought his Foley percussion to the world percussion sound and the rhythms. And it just, it's like you can feel these sculptures that are cast of bronze almost kind of start to move and start to come alive. And so it really is a dynamic ensemble of people that I think over the course of the performance, even though the music ebbs and flows depending on the inspiration of the piece, there's a consistency in concept and consistency in ensemble performance that kind of keeps it all as one experience.
You know, so talking about music is a little like talking about food. At a certain point, you want to stop talking about it and taste it. Why don't we play part of a track from that show, Sounds for Sculpture? And this one's called The Awakening.
I'm awakening.
Yeah, so that was very different from the first one, and there are lyrics in there, as you were just describing, and so it's a broad range of sounds in your show, I guess, the Sounds for Sculpture. Do you show the sculptures during the performance?
So, yeah, we one of the wonderful parts of the partnership with the Atelier is that they've given me the licensing to utilize the images of all the sculptures. So during each performance, we use high-resolution projection, and we actually project the images of the sculptures so that people can have, I guess, somewhat of a unique perspective of where the inspirational origin of each composition comes from. You know, when you think about going to hear a performance or a musician perform and they say, well, I'm going to do an original song, you know, they kind of have to tell you that story of maybe how that song, you know, what that journey was or where that inspiration came from. And this is kind of unique in the sense that we're able to actually show those images. And I think people can kind of depict their own interpretation of what that image might be and what that sculpture might be saying, and hopefully the music provides that kind of accompaniment for that, for, you know, the audience's imagination. So in some regards, we're actually able to travel with some of the physical sculptures depending on if we're on a part of an exhibition tour. It just adds a little bit more to the checked luggage weight with the bronze sculpture.
Yeah, I would say not throwing that in the overhead compartment. So, but I mean, the thing is, this is radio, obviously. If it were TV, we could at least show some images, but we can't do that here. But while we're talking, people can go to soundsforsculpture.com, soundsforsculpture.com, spelled like it sounds, and get a better idea visually of what we're talking about, because these sculptures are monumental in size and very avant-garde and very beautiful and very different, a wide range of appearances of the sculptures, right? So you can kind of get an idea of the variability, as we were saying earlier, of the music that's based on the variability of the sculptures. And if you go to soundsforsculpture.com, you can go to the gallery tab and see pictures of some of the sculptures. And on the main page, there are four complete tracks of music from the show that you can listen to. Another of your ventures, Christian, is called The Acoustic Confidential. Sounds kind of like an Anthony Bourdain thing. What was that about?
Yeah, you know, growing up as a jazz snob, I have always leaned towards acoustic music. I am not that guy that shows up at the nightclub with the booming music that, you know, it's just, you can barely, you know, you're trying to scream over to people to experience. It's just never been really my thing. I've always been drawn to the pure talent that comes from an artist sitting in front of their instrument or singing, whatever it might be, kind of in its purest, rawest form. And I feel like I was living in Vegas for many years, and the production there is huge, right? You know, you talk about, I mean, you know, my Sounds for Sculpture has projected images, and that's, you know, breaking the mold of the live jazz music experience. What do you mean? You've got images? Whoa, you know? And so you go out to Vegas and you go and see a show, and there's high there's LED walls, and there's people flowing in from the roof, and there's, you know, 35 dancers. And I was like, I thought I was just coming to see Tony Bennett.
And so
for me, like, live entertainment has gotten to this dynamic of production that is really so large that you can really only experience it in this kind of tiered theater style environment. And when I first got attracted to live music, it was sitting in these small jazz clubs or in these very intimate environments where there was only 30 or 40 or 50 people. And you were up close and you could really see the inner workings of the artist kind of perfecting their craft, whether it was telling their story, and emotionally connecting into it and playing their instrument and how that all kind of comes. And, you know, when you're in row 35F, 58 yards from the stage, that's hard to experience. And so I wanted to venture into creating a concert series that I could travel around all over the world to present really dynamic artists that could perform in this environment, are comfortable in this environment, and give an audience an experience that's, again, up close, personal, intimate, boutique in nature, and, you know, somewhat of a confidential, you know, it's only 100 seats. You can only get 100 tickets. If you don't know about it, you missed it. And so we've had the opportunity to present it in Las Vegas, in Aspen, Abu Dhabi, and it's a lot of fun. And, you know, it's just another way to kind of experience music that I think, I don't know, it's harder to find maybe nowadays. So, yeah, that was the thought process behind creating that entity.
Well, it sounds great. You know, people can go to christiantambur.com. Which is a separate website from the specific one for soundsforsculpture.com, christiantambur.com. The last name is spelled TAMBURR.com. And Christian, is your schedule of performances like you were just describing, is that on your website?
Yes, it is. I realized the other day that I have like five different websites. And so on christiantambur.com, which is kind of the headquarters.
The mothership.
The mothership. I have all of the performances listed. But at the Acoustic Confidential website, we have all those specific shows. And then, of course, shows listed for the Sounds for Sculpture. You know, I'm doing a lot of different things. So I find that it's easier, at least on my main website, to just list it all there. So, yeah, you can definitely find where I'll be.
You know, so again, part of the point of this show, I think, is to show the creative entrepreneurialism that it takes maybe to make a good living and to succeed in a visible way in the music industry. And so I'm kind of hitting on different elements of what you do, many of which are so diverse, right? So another one is, I read that you built a studio that develops creative ideas around shows on board cruise ships and in Vegas. So just kind of in a nutshell, what's that like and how does that work?
Yeah, you know, when I was 21 years old, I was living out in Las Vegas and playing five nights a week, straight ahead jazz. And all of a sudden, the gig that we were on wasn't happening. And I found myself going, okay, well, now what? And by the strangest situation, I sat in a room with Penn Jillette from Penn and Teller, and he asked if I could come and work on his show that they were standing up at the Rio. And I had never worked in, you know, I had never done music for middle-aged magicians before. So I, you know, but, you know, when you're a starving artist, you're just like, sure, I'll figure it out. And, you know, what I've found, especially playing an instrument like the vibraphone, which is somewhat unique, is you have to create the opportunity. And sometimes that opportunity isn't just going to be presented at the doorstep. Sometimes you got to create it. And so I found myself expanding the scope of what I could do as an arranger, as a composer. I was no longer just playing in a small group jazz ensemble. Here I am, working on a huge magic show in Las Vegas. And I love the collaborative aspects of working in theater and in production, because now you have creative ideas from a lot of people, a lot of chefs in the room, and you're trying to all get this beautiful vision together. And so I've had the great opportunity to work with Cirque du Soleil, Norwegian Cruise Lines, and a lot of these entities that put these beautiful shows up, and I get to bring parts of my music and part of my sound to these beautiful stages.
Hey, you mentioned earlier that you had worked with Julio Iglesias, and I think you were his musical director for a while and pianist in his traveling show. I imagine, obviously, that was a highlight of your career at that point, but you described how you ran into Penn. How did Julio Iglesias find you, or vice versa?
Yes, I was on tour in St. Petersburg, Russia, with my sextet, and I was about 25 years old, and I was in a cathedral, and a young guy came up to me and he goes, "Hey man, really liked your set. I'm a drummer." And I said, "Oh yeah," you know, because you meet a lot of drummers in this industry, and I should say you meet a lot of people who own drum sets. That's probably the best way to phrase that, you know. So I was, "Oh, that's nice, you play the drums, God, that's great." Anyway, we got to talking, and it turned out to be an incredible one of the top studio drummers in the world by name of Lee Levin. And he has recorded with everybody under the sun, including Julio Iglesias. And he's like, "Hey man, well, you know, if you ever want to do anything down in Miami, let me know. Let's keep in touch." And, you know, a simple exchange of a business card led into an email, which led to a, "Hey, would you be interested in, you know, working with a touring artist? They're looking for a keyboardist." And that turned into a phone call from Julio, which was amazing. Yep. I really wish I had recorded that call.
Oh, really?
It was, oh my gosh, "I'm going to take you around the world." And
sweep you off your feet.
Oh my gosh, yeah, exactly. And you know, it sounded like this is too good to be true. And so anyway, I spent 3 years touring with him, and that's how it happened. You know, it's just crazy. I mean, that's part of this industry, is just if it was easy, anybody would do it. I think one of the challenges in this industry is just like trying to carve that path forward. And so when you meet people that are unique, and you find yourself presented with unique opportunities, you go after them. You know, you maintain them.
Yeah, well, clearly you can't hide yourself in a closet, so you got to be out there. And when you're out there, opportunity does knock. And when opportunity knocks, you've got to be ready to open the door and step through it. So I think you do all those things. And a lot of people, they don't get out of the closet to start with, or they don't go through the door when it, you know, when it opens, you know, so you do those things. And I think that's a key, is basically just to keep moving and follow.
Yeah, no, you're spot on. You can't wait for the phone call. You can't wait for the phone to ring. You know, to me, the paradigm for me shifted when I became the person making the phone calls. And that was a big shift for me. And that was, becoming a band leader, right? And also, you know, kind of taking that leadership role of being like, well, now I want to shape what the vision is. And, you know, it's a ton of work. You have to have that get up and just hit it as hard as you can every day mentality. If you're just waiting for it to show up one day and, you know, surprise you, those are, you know, black swan events. You know, they come once in a while. But as to your point, when it actually comes down the channel, you got to know what to do with it, right? And how to jump. So,
yeah, we mentioned earlier that you do corporate training that's based in music. I'm guessing that that's at least one element of what you do in your training for corporate people based in music, is maybe the same idea we've just been talking about of acting on opportunities when they arise and recognizing them as an opportunity when they do arrive. So, you know, without talking a whole lot about the corporate training you do, which is a whole other little conversation, maybe to ask one quick question, does it take a little ice breaking to get groups of, you know, corporate drones involved in your, you know, prairie dogs?
It's interesting. Yeah, you know, the first thing we do is we come out, we play a song. And it's very much set up in that intimate environment. We usually do this for 50 to 100 people. And I set them up in a round. So they're very much close. And they're now watching the interworkings of an ensemble or the interworkings of individuals partaking in a high-functioning team. And so we really just kind of talk about the aspects of leadership, following and supporting, and the value of diversity amongst an ensemble, the value of inclusion, the value of collaboration that happens when musicians walk on stage every night. You know, this is what brings the richness and the culture and the beauty to the music that we love to play. And I do really believe that people, I think we all just kind of walk out there and it just happens. And so to break it down the way we do with Sonic Leadership, we're able to give them a little bit of the backstage insight of how this complex team comes together to, you know, deliver their, you know, their product out to our stakeholders, which is our music. So it's a lot of fun.
Well, Christian, even that sounds like fun, right? But we are out of time. So Christian, I want to thank you so much for being on with us on American Variety here today.
Oh, Court, thank you so much. It's great to speak with you.
Yeah, you too. And thanks to all of you for listening out there. I hope you'll tune in again next week, same time, same place, for more American Variety Radio.